Gomel was multiplying Raymond. If Yun Lo could manufacture one of these, he could manufacture an elite core of what could be the most extraordinary personal troops a leader could have. By having immutable loyalty built into a cadre of perhaps 100 men, a leader could not only take power, but he would become unseatable, because after the flawless, selfless guardians had removed the others, they could be conditioned to take portfolios under the new leader from which they would never, never plot against the new leader, and would reflexively choose to die themselves rather than see any harm come to him. Gomel felt himself grow taller. But all at once he thought of the power of Yun Lo, and it spoiled his vision. Yun Lo would have to manufacture these assistants. Who would ever know what else he had built into their minds, such as acting to kill within an area where they were supposed to be utterly immobile? He had disliked Yun Lo before this, but now he began to feel a bitter hatred toward him. But what could be done to such a man? How could fear be put into him to control him? Who knew but that he had conditioned other unknown men to strike at all authority if they were to hear of Yun Lo's arrest or death by violence? Or, for that matter, death under any circumstances whatsoever. Marco knew he was sick, but he did not know, nor did he seem to be able to make himself learn how to know why he thought he was sick. He could see Raymond sitting in calmness. He knew they were waiting out a storm in the Spring Valley Hotel, 23 miles from Fort Monmouth in New Jersey, and that they had been lucky indeed to have been offered the hospitality of the lobby, which, as everyone knew in the off-season, was reserved almost exclusively on Wednesday afternoon for the Spring Valley Garden Club. He was conscious of boredom, because he had little interest in flowers, except as a dodge to jolly a girl into bed, and although these ladies had been very kind and very pleasant, they were advanced in terms of years beyond his interest in women. That was it. There it was. Yet he sat among them, distorted by the illusion that he was facing a lieutenant general of the Soviet Army, 3 Chinese, 5 staff officers, and 6 civilians, who were undoubtedly Russian, because the bottoms of their trousers were 2 feet wide, and the beige jackets seemed to have been cut by a drunken chimpanzee, plus 1 randy broad who never took her eyes off his pants. He knew it was some kind of psychiatric hallucination. He knew he was sick. But he could not, on the other hand, figure out why he thought he was sick. Spring Valley was a beautiful, lazy place. A lovely, lovely, lazy, lazy place. Spring Valley. Yun Lo was explaining his methods of procedure. The first descent into the deep unconscious, he explained, was drug-induced. Then, after the insistence of various ideas and instructions, which were far too tenuous to take up time with, the subject was pulled out for the first time, and 4 tests were made to determine the firmness of the deep control plant. The total immersion time into the unconscious mind of the subject during the first contact had been 11 hours. The second descent was light-induced. The subject, after further extensive suggestion, which took up 7¾ hours and required far less technique than the first immersion, was then pulled out again. A simple interrogation test, based upon the subject's psychiatric dossier, which the security force had so skillfully assembled over the years, and a series of physical reflexive tests were followed by conditioning for control of the subject by hand and symbol signal and by voice command. The critical application of deep suggestion was observed during the first 11 hours of immersion, when the primary link to all future control was set in. To this unbreakable link would be hooked future links that would represent individual assignments, which would motivate the subject and which would then be smashed by the subject's own memory, or mnemonic apparatus, on a pre-signaled system emanating from the first permanent link. At the instant he killed, Raymond would forget forever that he had killed. Yun Lo looked smug for an instant, but he wiped the expression off before anyone but Berezovo had an opportunity to register it. "So far, so good," he said. The subject could not ever remember what he had done under suggestion, or what he had been told to do, or who had instructed him to do it. This eliminated altogether the danger of internal psychological friction resulting from feelings of guilt, or from the fear of capture by authorities, and the external danger existent in any police interrogation, no matter how severe. "With all of that precision in psychological design," Yun said, "the most admirable, the most far-reaching characteristic of this extraordinary technology of mine is the manner in which it provides for the refueling of the conditioning, and this factor will operate wherever the subject may be, 2 feet or 5,000 miles away from Yun Lo, and utterly independently of my voice or any assumed reality of my personal control. Incidentally, while we're on that subject, we presented one of these refueling devices to the chairman of your sub-rural electrification program, who faced a somewhat lonely and uncomfortably cold winter on the Gedan Peninsula. Our subject was a thoroughly conditioned young ballet dancer, whom the commissar had long admired, but she was most painfully, from his view, married to a young man whom she loved, not only outrageously, but to the exclusion of all others. Comrade Stalin took pity on him and called me. By using our manual of operating instructions, he found himself with the beautiful, very young, very supple dancer who never wore clothes because they made her freezing cold, and who undertook conditioned sexual conceptions which were so advanced that the commissar's winter passed almost before he knew it had started. They roared with laughter. Gomel slapped welts on his thighs with his horny hand. The recording assistant beside Berezovo couldn't stop giggling, a treble one-note giggle which was so comical that soon everyone was laughing at her giggle as well as Yun Lo's story. Berezovo finally rapped on the wooden back of the chair in front of him with the naked bayonet he was carrying. Everyone but Gomel stopped laughing in mid-note, but Gomel had just about laughed himself out and was wiping his eyes and shaking his head, thinking of what could be done with a beautiful, nubile young woman who had also been conditioned to kill efficiently. "Now," Yun Lo said, "to operate Raymond. It amused me to choose as his remote control any ordinary deck of playing cards. They offer clear, colorful symbols that in ancient monarchical terms contain the suggestion of supreme authority. They are easily obtainable by Raymond anywhere in his country, and after a time he will probably take to carrying a deck of the cards with him. Very good. I will demonstrate." He turned to the sergeant. "Raymond, why don't you pass the time by playing a little solitaire?" Raymond sat erect and looked alertly at Yun Lo. "Pull that table over, Raymond," the old Chinese said. Raymond walked to stage right and carried back with him a small table on whose top had been placed a pack of cards. He sat down. "The first refueling key was the sentence suggesting solitaire in those exact words, which unlocks his basic conditioning. Then, the Queen of Diamonds, in so many ways reminiscent of Raymond's dearly loved and hated mother, is the second key that will clear his mechanism for any assignment." As Yun spoke, Raymond had been shuffling the cards and was laying out the 7-card spread that is variously called Solitaire, Klondike, or Patience. "He will play the game until the Queen of Diamonds enters the play, which will be soon, because we arranged it in that way to save your time. Ah, here it is." Raymond's play had turned up the Queen. He scooped all the other cards together neatly, he squared them, placed them face down on the table, and put the Queen of Diamonds face up on top of the pack, then sat back to watch the card with offhand interest, his manner entirely normal. "May I have that bayonet, please?" Yun Lo asked General Berezovo.
"Not with the knife," Gomel barked. "With the hands."
"His hands?" Yun responded distastefully.
"Here," Berezovo said. "Have him use this."
He handed a white silk scarf to an assistant who carried it to Yun Lo. Yun knotted the scarf tightly in 3 close places, speaking to Raymond as he did so. "Raymond, whom do you dislike the least in your group who are here today?"
"The least?"
"That's right.
Well, I guess Captain Marco, sir."
"Notice how he is drawn always to authority?" Yun asked the group. Then he said to Raymond, "That won't do. We will need the captain to get you your medal." "Whom else?" Both Gomel's and Berezovo's translators were right at their master's ears, keeping up with the conversation in English on the stage.
"Well..."
It was a difficult question. Raymond disliked the rest of them in the same detached and distant way.
"Well, I guess Ed Mavoli, sir."
"Why?" He is a funny fellow, sir. I mean, very humorous. And he never seems to complain. Not while I'm around, anyway. Very good, Raymond. Now, take this scarf and strangle Ed Mavoli to death.
Yes, sir.
Raymond got up from the table and took the scarf from Jan. He walked to the end of the line of seated men at stage left, then moved along behind the row to a position directly behind Mavoli, fifth man from the end. Mavoli was chewing gum rapidly and trying to watch both Jan and Raymond at the same time. Raymond looped the scarf around Mavoli's throat.
"Hey, Sarge, cut it out! What is this?" Mavoli said irritably, only because it was Raymond.
"Quiet, please, Ed," Jan said with affectionate sternness. "You just sit there quietly and cooperate."
"Yes, sir," Mavoli said.